Welcome to Real World Theology, episode 69. On this episode, we are talking about Mission Impossible, Rogue Nation. This is the fifth installment in the Mission Impossible film franchise, and to help me talk about it, we have Mark Wingerter and, from Real Gospel, Sam Robinson. One of the first things we try to do is deal with the impossible task of remembering the plot of this film. And then we ask if it's really that important at all. We also talk about authenticity and the great stunts. We explore the morality and motivations of our hero, Ethan Hunt. And for the most part, we talk about why we really enjoyed this summer film. So here it is, episode 69, Rogue Nation and Authentic Action. Movie theaters are modern-day pulpits. Real-world theology exists to shed a light on the narratives that are shaping our culture, and to encourage viewers to recognize that entertainment is not mindless. So, how many movies a week do you see?
I try and see no more than one a week because it takes a lot of time out of everything else that I'm trying to do. And I've got to be careful about the way I spend my time. But there's a bunch of guys who write for the website. So if I can't get to see one, someone else generally can, which is cool.
How did Real Gospel start?
I just started it.
Boom, started. You were like, it's Thursday. I got nothing else to do. You don't want to start a website?
I was working for AFES, which I think is the equivalent of InterVarsity Fellowship in America. It's like the university student stuff. Mm-hmm. And so they were asking around Australia who wants to write reviews. And I thought, oh, cool, I'll do it. Because I used to work in TV, so I've got a bit of a background in media. And then I thought, okay. So I started writing reviews. I wasn't living in Sydney at that time. But then I was kind of writing reviews all the time. I thought I may as well make a blog out of it, and so I did. And then a few guys wanted to get on board and went from there.
And now every week.
When I can. At the moment, I've found with picking up this radio stuff, I've got far less time to do a lot of stuff, so the content's kind of dropped off a little bit online on the blog, but Yeah, it's fun. I enjoy going and thinking about movies and watching them, and it's free, cool, you know.
Yeah, I was going to say, that's one of the biggest things. We basically have to budget for it.
Yeah, well, I imagine in America, there's so many cities, whereas, you know, I'm in Sydney, which is where all the action is, so it's easier to get along to this stuff, but, you know, everyone's so spread out across 50 states, and yeah, I don't know how that works over there, but, Would you say that are there previews in every city?
I wouldn't necessarily say every city, probably the major cities. And even then, most of the previews and stuff like that are done in one of the major media outlets, which skips our state entirely.
Yeah.
So, I mean, you usually get like the New York, the LA, and you could also find stuff in probably like Atlanta, Denver, Dallas, like, you know, some of the biggest cities in America, but we're pretty far down that list.
But anyway.
Like I said, I was curious. I love to hear how other people's stuff got started. I love to hear kind of like just how you decided that was something you wanted to do one day, and how you're doing it now, and you know what that looks like. Because I guess kind of like similar to what you're describing, I said, you know what, I'm tired of people not really engaging film when they leave. I'm tired of the phrase, I just want to go and turn my brain off.
Yeah.
And I'm like, but look, like this, like you should be having great discussions. Like this film says so much, or it's discussing these things. Like, don't you want to talk about it? They're like, nope, I just want to see explosions.
It's too bad there's no Australian setting in this movie, because we could then talk about authenticity with you.
Well, there is Mission Impossible 2.
Oh, but see, nobody cares about that movie.
No, and I think
it's the worst.
I wonder whether Australia ruined it, because you don't really want to set an you don't want to set an action movie here. Like, really, come on! Of all the world places you could go, why Sydney?
No. Well, that's Pacific Rim went to Australia. It was great. Yeah.
Mm, that's true.
Well, so is that something that? I mean, because you have to realize, Sam, especially me, but probably Mark will completely believe you. If you tell us anything about Australia, like, you could be like, oh, it's well known that if you film a movie in Australia, your franchise will die.
Yeah.
You know, just be like, yeah.
I've been watching a lot of, Lost on Netflix since Netflix launched in March, because I missed it on TV. And I find it fascinating that, you know, Sydney is such a big feature of it. Although every time they have a scene in Sydney, you can so tell it's Hawaii. It's hilarious. It's so funny. It's like, Sydney Airport does not look like that. There are no palm trees in Sydney.
What? What do you mean?
But we all believe there are now.
But it's hot down there. There's palm trees where everywhere. I know. It's hot.
Gee, yeah. Monsoons and everything. Oh, man. Yeah. I don't know. It's funny. It's funny seeing Australia portrayed on American productions. Although, you know, I mean, things have been shot here. Wolverine and the Star Wars prequels. I mean,
wow, you really are killing your kid.
Wow.
Exactly. Don't shoot a film here. Babe Pig in the City, you know, all the good stuff.
Hey, yeah.
Australia, where films go to die. Oh, that's terrible. Well, see, I guess that's... Does... Oh, how do I want to ask this? Is there a... like an inside or regional thing where it's like, oh, well, if you want to do film right, you just need to go to New Zealand.
I don't know about that. I think, I mean, for example, Mad Max was excellent, and that was an Australian, and it wasn't, the latest one wasn't shot here, but it was a completely Australian crew and everything. So, you know, we've got that going for us at least.
You're getting there.
Did you like Mad Max? Fury Road? I loved it.
Oh, it was great.
Oh, yeah.
I think I've only heard one person that didn't like it, and I don't...
You actually heard a person that didn't like it?
Yeah, well, I didn't hear them. I guess I read a review from it, and...
You can't trust it.
It blew my mind. I was like... They basically said it was too gory, and I was like... oh, well...
I bet they love Game of Thrones.
Oh, gosh.
So, you know...
I don't understand how anyone could not like that. Like, I could get how people would be like, that was really great, and I don't ever need to see it again. I can even understand that, because it's just not some people's cup of tea.
Well, that's when Mission Impossible ads were running here, and they were all like, the best movie of the summer. And I'm like, no. Mad Max is the best movie of the summer.
Yeah.
I understand why you want to make that claim, but, you know, it's not. So can we stop calling it that?
Well, and that's what I was curious about, because, like, I didn't have to watch Mission Impossible, Rogue Nation, to know that there was no way it was going to be better than Mad Max.
Yeah.
You know? I could have high hopes. Like, I can't imagine any way a Mission Impossible film could be that good. Mm. And that's kind of, like, what I wanted to ask you guys. Like... I thought about, like, how do I start this conversation? Do I just start it with, did you enjoy the movie? Because we often start with, like, did you enjoy the movie? Or something like, was this movie any good? But you know, we try to stay away from bad and good. But I find that with movies in the Mission Impossible franchise that are basically priding themselves on stunt work and these over-the-top theatrics... I mean, they almost have no plot or character development most of the time.
Or
so,
too much plot or convoluted plot.
Well, yeah, I mean, but it's like a terrible plot, what do you say? Like, how do you really determine if a Mission Impossible movie succeeds? Like, how do you determine if it's any good? Like, if it if it doesn't do character development, if its plot isn't really comprehensible because it's too little or they try to do too much, when you recommend this film to somebody, how do you say this movie was good or not? I mean, like, so Sam, what we typically do is, like, anyone who gets on Skype, which is you,
yeah,
you get to kind of take a shot at most of this stuff first.
Okay.
So, how do you determine if Mission Impossible Rogue Nation is good? Or how do you determine if any of the Mission Impossible movies are good?
Yeah, I kind of, for me, I think it's the, I don't know. I think it's the balance that they get between silly silly and fun and action, I think, for me. And also the stunts. If the stunts are being, because I feel like they've got to keep raising the bar on the stunts. Like the mm-hmm. last film when he's clinging on the side of the skyscraper in Dubai with his, you know, glove.
Mm-hmm.
Like, how do you get more tense than that? And I don't know if they do that actually in Rogue Nation. I don't think if it gets any better.
Maybe if you drove a car out of one building into another building and then into another building.
Yeah, and so I think I can still enjoy the film, this one, because the stunts are really great, and I think they did a really good job of them. But, yeah, I think that's what I want to see. I want to think, obviously, as well, but I want to see and enjoy and feel like I'm part of it, I guess.
So you mentioned Ghost Protocol and how it kind of, you know, raised the bar for stunts.
Yeah.
But is there anything through the Mission Impossible franchise that's... Like, what makes a Mission Impossible movie better than another Mission... I mean, we already mentioned that Mission Impossible 2. Is it just because it was in Australia? Was that what made it terrible? Or what, was there something that Mission Impossible 1 and 2 or 3 maybe didn't do that... Was it just the stunts weren't impressive enough?
I think also the ensemble cast that we've got now makes a big difference as mm-hmm. well. I think
yeah.
it's not just about Ethan Hunt doing the thing himself. He needs help now. Or maybe, did he need help before? I'm struggling to remember.
Well, I think he did, yeah. There's always been a team.
To some degree.
Not in the first two, but the third one, you know, brought in Simon Pegg, and he's always had kind of like Ving Rhames and, you know, these outerlying... Some female character of some kind that has done, yeah.
But the amount
some female character of some kind.
I mean, basically, because they're kind of interchangeable in these movies, but...
Yeah. It's just interesting how often he needs rescuing in this latest one as well.
Mm-hmm.
I can't remember if that's been the case before. My memory's not great.
right.
Yeah.
Well, and that, I think that kind of possibly develops our female character in this one, something I want to talk about a little bit later, but I kind of want to see if Mark, if you, what makes a good Mission Impossible film?
Oh, well, I think it depends on how you define good. I mean, you know, a Mission Impossible film, you go into knowing what you're going to get. I mean, mm-hmm. at least now, maybe not when 3 was coming out, we kind of had a mixed bag of two different movies before that. But now, I mean, you know, you kind of know Tom Cruise's shtick, so... if it delivers on what it's expected to do and...
Which is what?
Well, you go into a Mission Impossible, and I was going to say it depends on how you define good, because if
yeah,
you,
like,
we're talking about...
What was it before in your eyes, and what made that shift?
Okay, well, if you look at Mad Max, perfect example. Mad Max takes a good look at the action movie, does it really, really, really well, great pacing, great action... And it also has, it kind of transcends that idea, not to use kind of like, I guess it feels like a snooty word, transcends, transcendent. But, you know, Mad Max had this wonderful character development that was really the heart of the story. The characters are not really the heart of the story in the Mission Impossible movies. The action is. And so there are certain movies that are good because they deliver on what they're supposed to. And that in the Mission Impossible movies is... outstanding stunt sequences mm-hmm. that keep you on the edge of your seat. Like, this movie is extremely well-paced, you know, and it's really, really enjoyable to see a well-paced, high-octane action movie. Whereas, you know, for instance, like, the first Mission Impossible kind of tried to transcend a little bit, but tried way too hard, and it came off as forced and, you know, very confusing and a kind of convoluted plot. Throughout until the end, and then it becomes kind of oversimplified. So it's it's kind of a strange it's reaching for kind of a psychological character progression of Ethan Hunt and this kind of, and it doesn't hit it. John Woo's, you know, Mission Impossible, the second one, is a John Woo-esque where it's just completely...
It's all about the doves.
It's, yeah, it's all about the doves flying up in the action sequence. You know, and then like slow-mo Tom Cruise with his goofy long hair, you know, and the stereotypical John Woo film action movie is kind of what you think of, like early 90s, late 80s kind of action movies that were just all about like the action hero that never gets hurt and never runs out of bullets.
Mm-hmm.
And so it very impersonal, takes you far away from the character. And that's what I think worked about the third Mission Impossible movie. And I wrote about this on the site, was that we were given a reason in the third movie to care about Ethan Hunt and to root for him.
Mm-hmm.
And that really kind of set up for me the 4 and 5, because I kind of cared about, you know, this character again, because he, you know, had somebody that he was fighting for and wanted to protect, and, you know, it was very dangerous. It felt tangible, the danger did. So this movie, however, really just delivers on the action and gives you that humor every, you know, at the right beat. It really is well paced. Like, it's very, very good. You sit there, eat, you know, eat your popcorn or candy or whatever, and just really enjoy a great action movie. Because, mm-hmm. I mean, action movie is a genre, and you want to see, in any genre, a good version of it when you pay to go see it. So this one, you know, did that. And it's there's a lot we can get into about, you know, character and, the, you know, kind of the plot and stuff in this one. But this one is all about the action. I think that's what these movies are doing very well. I think this is what Tom Cruise is doing very well in a lot of his movies lately. Does that answer the question?
No,
And kind of give a basis for that.
Well, I mean, it's discussion. Like I said, it's an opinion based. Like, we're all here talking about a new Mission Impossible movie because we heard that there was a new Mission Impossible movie coming out.
Mm-hmm.
And instead of being like, oh, great. Did we really need another Mission Impossible movie? We were all, I believe, excited. Like, Sam, you were excited, right?
Yeah, I was excited. I think I was... you talked about this in your last podcast that I listened to just the other day, superhero fatigue. And, mm-hmm. I mean, this is still an action film, but it's been a few years since we've seen Ethan Hunt on the screen, and I think that's mm-hmm. been a nice little break, and it's been good to get back into it. Yeah, and I'm sure that... I haven't looked at box office stats for this movie, but I assume it's doing well.
Yeah, I think it made 55, or, you know, somewhere in 55 million at least US last year,
mm-hmm.
which usually equates to pretty good worldwide gross.
Last week.
Last week.
Yeah.
Yeah. Did I say last month or
you
something?
Said last year.
Last year. Sorry.
Long time ago.
It was already making that much money.
Yeah.
Basically, when they were making this movie, they were like, we can count our money.
$55 million in the bank already. Come on. Yeah.
So, I wouldn't be surprised. Well,
yeah, I know.
So, I mean, so this movie was... Well, I guess I had a slightly higher expectation for this movie than just being a really good action film. And I will concede that, for me, pacing and action in this movie were completely enjoyable. I've had... I enjoyed Mission Impossible 3 for the reasons, Mark, you talked about, that, you know, we start caring about Ethan Hunt. Same thing in Ghost Protocol to a certain degree, too. And if not Ethan Hunt, some of the other team, that team aspect, Sam, you kind of talked about, too. So I was warming up to the Mission Impossible franchise. But at the same time, they just seem to go on for so long. Like, I want to be engaged mentally. Mm-hmm. At some point in between the action, and 3 and 4 to me, or, you know, 3 and Ghost Protocol, how, you know, just to make sure everyone's following, both at some point I was like, this movie's still going on, they've got to do another action, like, can't we just like there, like, he couldn't, you know, go to the bathroom without an action sequence, like, everything was an action sequence, and it was fatiguing, and I don't think this one really fatigued me, which was very surprising. But with bringing in a new director who also wrote the film, and Christopher McQuarrie, he wrote The Usual Suspects, one of my favorite screenplays. You know, he won an Academy Award for it. Mm-hmm. So he also wrote Edge of Tomorrow, which I really, really enjoyed last year, another Tom Cruise film. Didn't know how he was going to do directing, but I kind of expected, like, those have a lot going on upstairs. Those screenplays have a lot going on. And I kind of expected something like that, especially, you know, you do have the ensemble cast, you have Tom Cruise, Jeremy Renner, Simon Pegg, but you add in Ving Rhames, and almost like his small cameo-ish, just has to be in a mall now kind of role. But, you add a surprising female co-lead, I guess, mm-hmm. in Rebecca Ferguson, and you add Alec Baldwin, the greatest actor ever, to this cast, and I'm expecting they to dive in. But at the end of the film, and this is the question that I pose, that I didn't tell you I was going to get you guys to try to answer.
Well, whatever.
And if you can't, that actually works.
I'm okay. But, I'm a pro at this.
But
I'm not. I'm just kidding.
Sam, can you tell me what was the plot of Rogue Nation?
Ah, oh, come on. I was reviewing this the other day on radio. I'm like, it's basically an evil guy in a trench coat and black gloves. And he wants to take down the world with all these kind of mates who haven't really been successful. And and so they're getting together to form a rogue nation. And I think it's... you can
like,
just
do
take...
we know why? Did you get any...
No, not that I can remember.
Yeah,
after a couple of weeks. I think what really struck me with this film... was this that it didn't... I don't think it seemed to matter, the plot. And I've seen a lot of movies this year. I feel like there's been a lot of movies where you don't understand the plot and it sucks. But here, I think that you could still follow it along and go, look, it's the same movie again, basically. It's another impossible mission. He's going to get through in the end. He dies a couple of times in the film, doesn't he, really? And but by the end of it, you know, he survives. And I don't think it matters too much that you can't follow the plot too well. Because it's a ridiculous idea, and I don't think they care.
Mm-hmm.
Do you agree?
No, I think that's exactly kind of what I was hoping for.
Yeah.
Because, I want to give Mark a shot at it, too, because Mark might have picked up on more than I did.
Yeah.
But I remember seeing, walking out of the theater, going, I have no idea why anyone was trying to do bad things.
You know why that's interesting? Because we saw this movie together, and as the credits were rolling and the lights came up in the theater, you looked at me and you said, I think this is my favorite one in the series. So I'm shocked that you're saying this, because I thought you were going to be all behind this movie. And not that you're not.
No.
But I think that's the point we're getting to, is does the plot actually matter?
Yeah.
Because this was so enjoyable that, we're sitting here going, what is the plot? The plot is, this... former British intelligence guy creates an anti-IMF, basically a rogue nation is what they call it, which I don't really know why they call it a rogue nation.
it sounds so,
but
cool.
It's just like him. These are all former intelligence.
The syndicate.
Yeah, these are former. Yeah,
sorry,
former intelligence agents that are now carrying out his missions, and his mission is to.
His mission is something.
I think I remember it as he's trying to run his own. Truthfully, I don't know. I can't do it.
Okay, so I thought really hard about it, and I was like, okay, I thought I remember him something like throwing
wants,
some words about
well,
like evolution and human nature.
Change. He wants to change the world.
Yeah, he wants to take power away from
take
people.
Take power away from people who are
because reasons.
Yeah, because reasons.
Okay. So. Yeah. This entire line of questioning, Mark has kind of spoiled it a little bit because we did see it together. And I did think this was probably the most enjoyable one. But, it's the difference between, this is the most enjoyable Mission Impossible to me, but it wasn't, an amazing movie. This isn't, a 4 out of 5 or 5 out of 5 star movie to me. But even with that said, I really wanted to say... then why are we going to see it? What is drawing us to this film? What makes us okay with seeing movies that are basically vehicles for stunts and cool stunts? And I like what Elijah Davidson said over at Real Spirituality, because he himself, at Real Spirituality, they do something very similar to Real World Theology. They do something very similar to Real Gospel. And he's asking whether there is a lot that they can pull out of the film theologically.
Mm.
And he basically settles on the fact that when he sees a movie that does stunt work well or does action sequences well, and this kind of goes to what Mark, you were saying earlier, it's impressive. In and of itself, that's just fun to watch, and it's intriguing, and it is compelling. And Elijah Davidson kind of surmises that when that happens, you can kind of reflect on how incredible of a creation like human beings are to be able to do these incredible things, to create these over the top, you know, sometimes hilarious, sometimes silly, but there are people doing these things. Like the human body is this incredible creation. The imaginations of these people to continue to show us something that we don't think we've ever seen before. Or like, you know, like you said, Sam, it's basically the same formula, but they change it up enough or they add enough to it that it seems new. And that in and of itself, being able to stop and reflect on our ability to create and the way at least in, you know, from our theology, the way that the Creator has created us, and then we respond in with creation through that. I'll give, you know, I wouldn't say.
Well, and you know, in a positive note for this particular film, I think, you know, we're talking about this idea of creation, because it's really cool. You know, that one, the one article that we read as research for this was kind of basically looking at the verse, feel fearfully and wonderfully made.
That was the real spirituality.
Yeah, that was, was it? I don't know.
Yes.
But anyway, so we look at these, you know, movies, and we, you know, especially us three, we are consuming films a lot, especially the big budget ones right now and the big blockbusters and stuff. And talking about what we're able to create, you know, we're essentially, filmmakers are essentially illusionists. They want to get you to believe something that's, you know, not real, and they made up, you know, in a lab or a studio or wherever it is. And so we as the audience, and of course we as human beings are believers, we want to believe in something, you know, whether you put that into a religious aspect or you put that into just an everyday life aspect, you want to kind of escape and that kind of thing. We want to believe in things. And this movie, and Tom Cruise in general and his kind of philosophy about making action movies, they want to do, you know, the what we call now the old school. You know, they want to really do it. They really want to blow up the car. He really wants to get on the side of a plane and take off, which is insane.
Very
insane. Because he literally could die. I mean, Tom Cruise could, Tom Cruise making a movie next year and do something stupid like that. And something could fail, and we could read about Tom Cruise died trying to do a stunt. I mean, literally, we could.
But he'd be okay with that because his thetans would return to the...
Well, actually, he's... Okay, but not to go off on a tangent, he's actually backing away from Scientology. He's leaving Scientology. That's the new kind of rumor going around.
That's anyway, the word on the street.
Yes, not to get into Tom... Let's not talk about Tom Cruise as the person. Well, let's talk about as the action star.
Okay, well, I want to stop for just a second.
Okay.
Because we actually are privy to something very powerful right now. If the word on the street is that Tom Cruise might be leaving Scientology, we have someone on the podcast right now from the future.
Oh, yeah.
Like, one day in the future, Sam, is Tom Cruise still in the Church of Scientology? In the future.
I'll just have to Google that.
Your Google is one day ahead.
How does Google work in the future?
Yeah, it's just as pretty.
Okay, I'm glad I stopped the entire podcast for that bit.
Before Mikey took my, you know, a little perfectly nice little point and went on a tangent... what I was trying to say is this idea of like doing these stunts, actually doing them, and kind of it gives it that sense of reality that, you know, as good as CGI is now, I mean, you look at the CGI of like just the Marvel films, it's stunning, it's amazing, but there's this sense of, you know, distance that CGI creates that these movies try to bring back. And so that's, you know, as far as filmmakers being illusionists and really doing it versus like creating it in a computer, these movies do what, that's what action movies are supposed to do. They're supposed to, you know, strap you in and get you to believe what's going on. And these movies do that better than other movies have recently. That's that's why Mad Max's action was so good, because they did a lot of that without CGI. They did a lot of that just going out in the desert. They built those crazy cars and just started to blow up things. And that's what this movie does. He really rides the motorcycle. He's really driving that car because they literally could not find a stunt driver better than Tom Cruise to drive the car in the time they had to film it. I mean, that's just an amazing thing. So he is actually doing all this stuff, and it really adds to that believability that we really want from action movies. So kind of going back to that reason of why this is good versus other ones or not. I mean, this is, it's really, you know, we're not going to see doves flying up if there's a car coming through all the time, you know, John Woo. You know, we're going to see the car, you know, break a, you know, a wall and, you know, kind of swerve the other way and go down, you know, stairs. It's not, you go down steps, concrete steps backwards, you're going to flip over like it did, you know. I mean, it's just cool that, in, you know, and the director, of course, you know, Colin McQuarrie, he is a stunt guy. He's a stunt director, and now he's directing action movies, so it's appropriate. So that believability really lends itself to us as seeing what we can create. It gives it just something more.
I've got a question on that, though. Do you think that people will know that it's real? Because, like, I went to see this with my wife, and we were watching the plane scene at the start, and I said, you know, they actually did this. And she said, really? Really? Can they? And so I think I agree with you that definitely they're doing the stunts and you can see that. But I wonder if we're at the age now where we see films and we just assume everything is computer and they can do it at a point that it looks real. You know, like we all know that it's, they actually did these scenes. And so I think, like, I was talking about Mad Max. When I was watching that, I was just sitting there with my mouth open watching that, the scene where they're on the poles just swaying from side to side on the top of the cars. Yeah. And I think, how do you even do that? And I felt like this as well with Mission Impossible. But I wonder, are we going to get to the point where these scenes... I mean, I can always tell when computer animation is done, especially when it's done badly, but are we as an audience globally losing the impression that these things are actually real?
Well, so there's this... I think there's something that's non-quantifiable. So this is completely an opinion.
Yeah.
Well, but we are not about opinions.
We're not about, we're only facts. and I say this is an opinion, but I think, I'm pretty sure it was on Slash Film earlier this week. There was a video that was like debunking the movies that don't use CGI. Kind of pointing out that they use CGI all the time.
Mm-hmm.
Like Mad Max was full of CGI scenes.
Well, yeah.
But it's how you use CGI.
Mm-hmm.
Like, if you can actually... Like, there's something that CGI hasn't been able to recreate in human expression or unreasonable... Or what I would consider unreasonable human movement. Like, when a stunt person does a film, like, they're probably going to wince or make a face that isn't planned or it bump something in a weird way, or just align themselves to protect themselves in a way that you can't predict, like a completely CGI'd thing, which is why I think it's a really big deal. And I would argue for motion capture people like Andy Serkis, like that's what made Dawn of the Planet of the Apes so lifelike. I mean, like the whole thing, like they were CGI'd. Yeah, I guess if that can be a verb.
Right.
But like, but their facial expressions, their mannerisms, that was all, you know, captured in a way that if you would have just made it, like if you would have let George Lucas do it and Episode One it, then you know it would have been like wacky or silly looking. Or,
well, I mean, even to, you know, not that we need to defend that movie at all, but Jar Jar Binks was motion capture, so I mean, you know.
Yeah, but not by Andy Serkis.
Yeah, it's true.
No, but so I think there's something there that people, like, I'm able to connect to Tom Cruise in an action film. I'm able to connect to the stunts in Mad Max because I can tell that lots of those people are real people doing those things. Yeah. Even if some of the explosions around them are not real, you know, even if some of the stuff in the background is not real, I think there's something that I can tell.
There's something to be said about intent. You know, the intent of the creator. You know, is and you it comes across in film. You know, whoever is creating the film, and I think, you know, that's why Tom Cruise on all of his action movies is like, don't put me in front of a green screen. I want to actually do it. You know, and even on the side of that plane, you know, I saw the, you know, two or three minute making of that scene, and you know, you can watch that video online. But he's like, you know, they're like, well, we'll strap you the heck down, man. We'll just, you know, CGI out all the cords and cables. And he's like, no. I only want one harness, just one harness, because it will come across in my performance if I feel like I'm safe. Mm-hmm. I'm like, safe on the side of a plane taking off. But
like, how many harnesses would possibly make you?
I
feel
know.
Safe?
I wouldn't feel. I wouldn't save at all. You know. But I mean, that's him, and so he wants to. He wants authenticity, and I think we, you know, as film goers, as people, we want authenticity in everything. That's why I really feel like it's a cultural. It's becoming even more of a cultural idea to want authenticity, even though it's greatly inherent because we have a lot of sugary pop things mm-hmm. in our culture, but we want authenticity because we want. You know, it's almost like we don't want to be betrayed by what we're trying to believe in, even if it's momentarily and silly and frivolous, like an action movie, or if it's religion. I mean, people don't want to put their effort and their money and their time into something that's going to be inauthentic and just, you know, rip the rug out from under you mm-hmm. with its illusion.
No, I think people definitely that if you at you know you take a street survey, you know. Late night show street survey,
right.
And would you want something authentic or inauthentic? And people will almost always authentic.
Yeah.
We want our friendships authentic. We want our politicians authentic. We want our Mexican food authentic. Mm-hmm. We want everything authentic.
Yeah,
we want it local. We want to know where it came from. You know, we want almost everything this way. Now, unfortunately, we don't always get that. And I would say that. Sometimes people are too easy to believe something is authentic if it's not really. But I, as much as I sometimes don't have faith in humanity to sniff out inauthentic things, I think more often than not, there is something that comes across in an authentic performance. It's why anytime Daniel Day-Lewis is in a movie, he gets an Oscar.
Yeah.
Because he completely immerses himself. He doesn't come out of that character. He will give you as much of an authentic performance as possible.
Right.
And while I would not really equate talent-wise Tom Cruise to Daniel Day-Lewis mm-hmm. on purely acting skill, I appreciate the fact that Tom Cruise is trying to give us an authentic look mm-hmm. at doing the impossible.
Right. Yeah, and I think, you know, film goers, you don't really have to try that hard to get us to believe. Because, I mean, how many crappy CGI movies have you seen and you like the subject content or whatever, you like the actor or whatever, and you're trying hard. I mean, you're trying hard to believe.
Wait till you see Fantastic Four.
I'm not going to see Fantastic Four. Because they didn't CGI. Try. Yeah. I mean, good CGI doesn't necessarily make a good movie. I mean, Chappie was a horrendous movie, but it had great CGI.
It had great CGI.
You know, Elysium, not to, you know, kick on Neil Blomkamp, but I mean, mind-blowing CGI, immersive CGI, mm-hmm. terrible, terrible movie. But, you know, then you have this movie. Great movie, but they go for the real action. You know, and I think it's all goes back to the heart of the creator, the person who has the intent to create a film. If you care about it, it's going to come across on the screen because, you know, how do you decide when you're making an action movie, how much CGI to use, how much authentic action to use? It depends on the film. It depends on the story. It depends on the type of, you know, genre movie or whatever.
I would assume this is... I guess similar or because I would argue it's at a human nature level, but Sam, you can correct me if it's different down under. Don't laugh when I say down under.
I mean, do you use that terminology? Do you call yourself down under, Sam? I mean, no, like you're like, no. Oh yeah, down under.
He told me before you got here that he does nothing else but refer to himself as down under. Uh-huh. I'm like, where are you at right now, Sam? He's like, down under. No, and I said, awesome.
You guys are just up. We're
yeah, I was about to say,
are
we?
We're up over.
Are we up above?
Up over. No, so
the Pacific.
So I think it would probably transcend cultures, but my guess is that Christianity is, or at least the way I've seen it here, is most effective when it's authentic. I think there is a, especially where Mark and I reside in America, you know, the Bible Belt. There's an inauthentic Christianity. There's a cultural Christianity.
I was gonna say cultural, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, so it you know, cultural Christianity comes off as very inauthentic. Mm-hmm. It comes off as, you know, something that you were raised in. It's more of a social construct than anything else.
Mm-hmm.
But there are very few people, well, there are always exceptions to the rule, but there are fewer people that I know who have come in contact with someone practicing authentic Christianity, Christian sacrifice, Christian love, that have not been either won over or changed or at least made to stop and think. And I mean, lots of the people that I know who I would say converted to Christianity at some point in their life usually have had people who are demonstrating the authenticity of the faith to them.
Mm-hmm.
And I would assume that that's not different in Australia.
Well, it's, I mean, it's anything authentic is, you know, more valuable and more attractive to people.
Yeah, I think I don't really, I guess it's a very different culture here to the Bible Belt. I struggle to understand. I mean, Australia's roots are in Christianity, but it doesn't feel like that anymore. And I was watching, I actually reviewed a Christian film that came out of, I assume, the Bible Belt, called Past the Light, which came out earlier this year, or last year. I didn't really like it at all, but I couldn't relate to it because everyone in the town was supposedly Christian. And I know that's a cultural thing, but I couldn't relate to that here. And I couldn't work out who... It does just seem cultural there in many ways and surface level, but not genuine. I'm completely different in the context here because, you know, if you're a Christian, you're definitely not the norm. And you know, persecution isn't, you know, you still got freedom of speech and everything like that here, freedom of religion, which is fantastic. But I think that's true. We can often be on about spreading a message, but if a character of the person spreading the message isn't genuine, people see through that. And so I think that's something that's been challenging me lately, especially. I've been actually at the moment, before we did this podcast, looking at James 2, you know, faith and deeds and how, you know, genuine faith is required. Deeds are required out of genuine faith, right? You can't separate the two. I've gone on a bit of a tangent, I think.
Yeah, well, it's kind of like what we're saying is that authenticity is transcends cultural boundary. I mean, if it is a cultural boundary, it is ultimately inauthentic in a way.
Mm.
I mean, most things, not even just religion, anything. I mean, if you like that, like the film that you're talking about, Past the Light, which I just IMDb'd, by the way, and just the poster looks terrible. But you know, I can imagine
it was a terrible movie. Yeah,
the CGI in it was awful. You could see right through it.
Terrible. But it's almost like, you know, that having a culture, and I know we have cultural things that are authentic. I'm not trying to say that it's the be all end all to be transcendent to be authentic. But in terms of belief, in terms of things that make us human, if it has a kind of a cultural boundary, then it is ultimately going to end up inauthentic in a way, I guess. Because, I mean, look at Mission Impossible. I mean, hanging off a plane is hanging off a plane. I mean, you know what I'm saying? Like, it's anywhere you are in the world, if somebody's hanging off a plane, that's dangerous, you know? So, I mean, seriously, I mean, you're climbing on the Burj Khalifa in Dubai on, you know, the 110th story up in the air. I mean, that's, you know, that's dangerous. It's kind of a thing that makes you human, and maybe CGI in a way kind of takes away from that. I mean, you see the Hulk, you know, pounding through walls and stuff. I mean, that's inauthentic, but we want to believe it still. It's a strange thing, I guess, to argue.
Well, I just love the fact that somehow we've taken Mission Impossible, Rogue Nation, and gotten to this point.
Yeah.
I just, hopefully that would be an encouragement to lots of people who think that, I mean, given Mark and Sam and I, like, we obviously do this fairly regularly. We typically don't go to a movie and not think about it on a deeper level. But I remember I saw lots of people in church this past weekend who said, "Hey, did you see Mission Impossible?" I was like, "Yeah," and I wanted to like kind of start something. It was so hard. But most of them were like, "Yeah, it's not really one of those thinking movies." Mm-hmm. And I wanted to be like, there's always something. Like, it's going to lead you somewhere. And I love the fact that even with Mission Impossible, we're doing this. But with that, I kind of want to change gears a little bit too. Because there's something that really annoyed me about this film. And it really annoys me about the Mission Impossible franchise as well. And that's that the female character, the main female character, is replaced in every Mission Impossible film. And, you know, 20 years ago, I kind of get that they were doing the whole throwaway Bond girl kind of thing. You know, they had that template to work from. Mm-hmm. But I thought that with Ghost Protocol, they finally had a full-time team member in Paula Patton. And, you know, she took the phone. You know, Simon Pegg took the phone. Jeremy Renner took the phone. They had a team. I was like, mm-hmm. Finally, we don't just get someone who's coming in for a movie and leaving. And she was nowhere to be seen.
Right.
But, and this might just be me holding out hope or holding out just basically hope that things are changing, because I think it's a little ridiculous, and I can't believe people don't talk more about it, especially in the pseudo-feminist climate we've had through a lot of 2015 in film.
Mm-hmm.
Like, one, can we just all agree that Rebecca Ferguson, like, totally killed it in this movie? And two, is can her character, Isla Faust, break the mold?
Ilsa,
sorry. I had it. Typo. I was like, that didn't sound right. Can Ilsa Faust break the mold? Do you think that we'll get her character back for Mission Impossible 6, which will be in, what, 2017 now?
Yeah.
Sam?
Yeah, I was really impressed with her. I thought she did a good job. I mean, at the start, when we couldn't tell whether she's good or bad, you know, that's pretty typical, right? That we see that a lot. Mm-hmm. And so I mm-hmm. thought, is this going to be the same character again? But I think the fact that she saved Ethan's life a couple of times, I think that's right, isn't it? She did that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. I think that, you know, again, part of the team. I'd like to see her back in another film. I think... Mm-hmm. It'd be nice to just keep a bit of continuity, as they have with the other ensemble cast members over the last few films.
Well, I think it's a filmmaking, it's not necessarily a story choice, it's just a filmmaking problem having to do with contracts and actors and mm-hmm. actresses, well, in this case, actresses getting popular. You know, Paul Patton was getting popular, very popular around the time that movie came out, and that kind of helped boost her. And so she's, you know, a busy actress now. And so I don't think that if she would have come back, I'm sure they would have loved to have her. But it doesn't seem like it was like they kind of write these scripts as they kind of figure out how the production's going to go. I mean, really. So it's like, oh, we can't get Paula Patton back, so we won't put her in the script. Let's figure out another female character. What if she's, you know, Ethan Hunt's equal? You know, I don't know if it went that way exactly, but that's a way that it can go. But you also have to remember in these films that they always replace other people. Like, they always have the government bureaucrat number one guy, you know, who is like the one that tells Ethan that he has an impossible mission, or doesn't want him to do the impossible mission, or wants to shut down the IMF. You know, the first one was John Voight. He was kind of he ended up being a sort of a main character. The second one was Anthony Hopkins. The third one was Lawrence Fishburne. The fourth one was Tom Wilkinson. This one was Alec Baldwin. It's always that guy. It's never the same guy.
So you think Alec Baldwin might not be back?
I don't think he'll be back. I mean, look at the trend. I mean, there's five movies, five different guys. I would love to have Alec Baldwin back. I thought he was a great part of this movie.
Yeah.
And I would love for them, for crying out loud, to stop shutting down the IMF and just let the IMF do its job. Literally, the past three movies have been about shutting down Ethan Hunt. Let's not let him do his job.
Is it not really weird that this was like Rogue Nation, and it looks like it's going to have the exact same plot as Spectre is later this year?
Right, yeah.
Also, using the word rogue, so... It's got the plot of Bond and the name of the Star Wars movie. Well, like, they're doubling down.
And originally, this movie was supposed to come out closer to Christmas, mm-hmm. which is, you know, Bond's coming out in, what, November? Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So, and they moved this back to the summers. I wonder if that probably had anything to do with it.
We win!
Yeah, right. pretty much.
They don't have Christoph Waltz, which would have put them over the top.
True. Well, maybe he'll be the next, like... token bureaucrat guy that's trying to shut down the IMF.
The impossible team is gone. You can't do it anymore. It's Microsoft Waltz.
Is that it?
Is it?
Okay. No, I wasn't sure.
Hater.
Anyway, I think they... I don't know that the female replacement was necessarily on purpose. And even if it was, I mean, Rebecca Ferguson just knocks it out of the park. I mean, mm-hmm. She kills it. She's wonderful in this movie, and I hope they bring her back. You know, yeah. I hope they do another. Well, they are doing another Mission Impossible, but
well, so this movie is popular enough mm-hmm. that the Mission, or at least what I've seen, is the Mission Impossible franchise is not above evolving itself.
Right.
We've already discussed that. It did one. It was like let's double down on action, and it was like, that was a mistake, mm-hmm. you know, at least the way that, you know, that John Woo did it or whatever.
Yeah.
And then it changed. It's like, let's care about Ethan Hunt. Let's, mm-hmm. you know, so J.J. Abrams comes in, does some really great action stuff, gives us reason to care about Ethan Hunt. Brad Bird comes in. He's like, let's make this just an amazing film to watch. Let's go further than anybody's gone before. And now I think they've really played up the ensemble. Like, there was ensemble in Ghost Protocol, but I still think it was about the stunts. This one, I think, was about the interactions.
Yeah.
And that team.
Yeah.
I mean, and the stunts.
And the stunts.
Don't get me wrong.
And the stunts are pretty incredible.
But, I mean, so maybe, like, there's enough, if there's enough groundswell for Simon Pegg, Alec Baldwin, Rebecca Ferguson, maybe they're like, hey, we can just, I know this has been the formula, but maybe we can change that formula a little bit, because people want to see this.
Mm-hmm.
Possible, Sam?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, even though we're getting the same story pretty much every time and there's changing of characters, I still feel like there's evolution with these films. And so I think there's room to change, break the norm, break the formula. I'd love to see Alec Baldwin back. Mm-hmm. just, I don't know. It took me a while to work him out in this film. I don't know if you feel like that as well. Whether he was playing the same character that he plays on 30 Rock.
30 Rock,
or not.
Yeah.
And then what was that line? I wrote it down here. The line at the end of the film: "Hunt is the living manifestation of destiny." Like,
yeah,
what was that?
That was very 30 Rock. Yeah, I loved that when he was like so totally on his side. It wasn't even funny.
Yeah,
you know, like it was great because that whole scene where the prime minister is, mm-hmm. you know, like you drunk from the shot, basically that they get. I mean, it was just really, that was a great scene.
Mm.
Yeah. So again, that reminds me, one of my favorite quotes from your review, Sam, is talking about how the fact that like this basically is the same movie over and over again.
Yeah.
And you said, considering we've reached the fifth installment in the Mission Impossible franchise, it would appear that Ethan Hunt's risky missions are in fact possible.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I love how the film plays with that, but it does. It does still give us some things to talk about, and I do wonder, I guess, by any other measuring stick. I mean, is Ethan Hunt good, or is he just really driven? And is that enough for us to root for him?
Mm.
Like I see him as like a person who drives towards a goal, but mm-hmm. lots of times I feel like he's just an empty shell, like who is doing a thing because a thing needs to be done, not necessarily because he's a good person or mm-hmm. has a moral compass. Like, is that a lack of character development? Is that me just missing?
Yeah, I it took me a while to work out, and I don't know if I still understand what motivated him to go rogue.
Mm-hmm.
In this film, like IMF got shut down and he went and dealt with it himself, but I don't know if I really understood why. Did you guys get that?
I mean, that's the thing, I didn't really. And and I would point again to your review, Sam, because in your review over at Real Gospel, like, you point to the fact that the film might be a good springboard to talk about people, or to talk to people about where we find our identity. And
yeah.
And I would ask, like, if you had to speculate, where do you think Ethan Hunt gets his identity? Like, is it his relationship with his friends? Is it just, like, he wants to be the best at his job? You know, is he just a workaholic and his work looks way cooler than our work? Or does does he seem to have like a moral compass? Like he's just a do-gooder. Like he always has to do the right thing, which we assume is the right thing, because it doesn't always seem like the right thing.
Yeah, I think he's definitely driven. I don't really understand why he's driven, but it seems as though he is more reliant on other people in this film and the last film, as he maybe in previous, maybe in three as well. But yeah, I don't really know where his identity lies. I think it's similar in a lot of these movies where you've got a secret agent that it's never really explained why maybe it's just their whole world.
Mm-hmm.
And it's exactly what that's all they know.
Whereas we're just kind of, you know, in my view of it, in at least in the last two movies, this movie and the one before it, Ghost Protocol, we're just kind of supposed to accept that Ethan Hunt's the good guy.
Mm-hmm.
Because we've seen him, you know, in movies past, just do all the good things and fight for the good side.
Which we assume is the good side, because...
We assume it's the good side, yeah. I mean, they don't really... These movies don't get into the blurred lines, you know. They don't get into the gray areas of, like, well, what is really the right or wrong thing versus the good or evil thing. You know, and they, you know, we really haven't had a true counterpart to Ethan Hunt, even though they might have alluded to the fact that the bad guy in this one could have been an Ethan Hunt counterpart. He's, you know, kind of doing what he thinks is good for his cause. Because we don't really remember the plot, but it was something to do with that.
does that make Ethan one of the most perfect everymans or everymen? Because like, is he our Luke Skywalker?
I mean,
you know, is he like the blank canvas that we're just experiencing? Like he is so blank. Besides doing the right thing, that we can assume without much pushback that he believes what we believe. Like he's all about this or all about that, and like you and I could maybe believe two different things, but we could both somehow think Ethan believes in our cause because he's such a blank slate.
I think if that's true, then it doesn't really work.
Because
I think having too blank of a slate doesn't really give you anything to root for. If that's the case, we're not rooting for Ethan Hunt. We're just rooting for the right thing to happen and the bad guy to get killed.
Yeah, but we're rooting for our ideals that we're imposing on Ethan.
Well, we're not necessarily imposing them on Ethan. We're imposing them on the characters in the movie and the plot itself. We're imposing, just, you know, because just as much as we're imposing it on Ethan, we're imposing it on Simon Pegg's character, we're imposing it on the bad guy, you know, that he is the bad guy, you know, and so I don't know if it works like it does in the third movie, and that's why I think the third movie is my personal favorite of the Mission Impossible movies, but, you know, I think that movie works the best because it gives us something to root for Ethan for. Ethan is motivated in that movie by something far clearer than he is in the other films, and that's that he simply wants to save his wife.
Mm-hmm.
You know, his wife-to-be, his fiance, person he loves. He is in it and has a dog in the fight.
I really wanted you to say he is in it to win it.
In it to win it.
He is. It.
You know, he has a reason to go and steal something. You know, they go and steal that rabbit's foot, whatever the heck that was, you know, which they actually literally, they don't ever say what it is. But some kind of nuclear device or whatever. He goes and helps the bad guy because he has, you know, a reason to do that. It's a dog in the fight. He has a piece in the game that he has to protect and save. And, you know, I think that gave him more of a human side than, you know, any of these other movies. But it's kind of like, you know, we look at just the current example that we're comparing this to, Mad Max. You know, we don't know anything about Max in the movie. We don't really ever know anything about Max. But you're not rooting for Max. You're rooting for the right thing to happen.
Yeah.
You know, you're rooting more for Charlize Theron and her incredible character. You know, and for her to find justice and redemption for herself and justice for the women that she's trying to protect. I mean, that's something to root for, but you're not rooting for Mad Max.
Mm-hmm.
So you're not rooting for Ethan Hunt in this movie.
Mm.
Like you are in the third one. You're rooting for Ethan Hunt. You want him to win to save his wife. You know, because if Rogue Nation had ended with Ethan Hunt dying, you know, the good thing would have happened, and we wouldn't necessarily be as upset as if in the third one his wife actually did get killed.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know what I'm saying? Like, I think it's he is kind of the pawn that we insert ourselves to play out our story, to follow our hero, to be kind of our everyman.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't think that... I think he's a little too blank in this for him to be the only investment that we have in the story.
Mm. I'm down.
Okay.
Yeah, me too. I agree.
All right. Okay.
You had me at, well, actually.
I didn't mean to throw down... I didn't mean to throw down the gauntlet of truth on you guys.
Hey, sometimes I just ask a question because I want to hear the answer.
Okay. Yeah. Hey.
Hey. Well, let's start. Okay, so let's start shifting to wrap up. And I call it wrap up, but it's still like another hour of our time. It's not really an hour. But in doing this, we take a look back at this film and we say, what made us say, come on, oh my gosh, or just didn't sit well with you, whether it be a character, whether it be a scenario, a scene, a plot device, you know, bad writing, anything basically can fit under here. Something that you did not like about this movie. And again, Sam, you get to go first.
Yeah, I think first of all, sorry about that noise. First of all, for me, it was the length of the film. I think it went a bit too long. It was over 2 hours. And normally, I mean, I think most of the time the action was fine. But yeah, I feel as though it could have been a little bit more punchy. I don't know if you felt like that as well. But by the end of it, I'm like, yeah, I've enjoyed this. I've enjoyed the stunts, but time to go home. the other thing, too, was the underwater scene when he's in that, which is I think was so well done, floating around. That he had 3 minutes of oxygen countdown on his thing, and it went forever. It went for... Mm-hmm. 6, 7, 8 minutes, I reckon. I don't know. Yeah. It's at the point where you're like, maybe it's the same as the length. It loses that impact and that punch.
Mm-hmm. I actually thought during that scene when they set their watches that we were not going to get more than a 3-minute scene.
Yeah, exactly.
I thought they were actually going to do that.
That would have been apropos. Yeah, that would have been perfect.
Because I thought that would have been something that we don't actually see, because we always get, you know, 15-minute, 1-minute scenes.
Yes.
You know?
Yes.
And I'm like, really? Really? Yeah. So I think that's legit. And, I mean, I think anything that you didn't like is legit because it's your opinion.
Yeah.
That's right. Yeah.
And you're a smart guy. So, because I think normally I would agree with you on the length of the film as well.
Mm-hmm.
It's just that the other ones felt so long to me that this one felt shorter. Even though I could have been fine with, like, probably one less action sequence.
Yeah.
I mean, but, like, I felt... Because I think, Mark, you're the one that said it was probably paced really well.
It was paced very well. I mean, it does get overlong because we don't necessarily need that length, but it earned the length for me.
Well, I didn't feel like any of the particular scenes, the action scenes themselves... I felt like the action scenes in 3 and 4... they went on for a long time.
Yeah, it
like
was
the actual scenes. Like right. But this one, I felt like the car chase was pretty short. It did back itself up to the motorcycle chase.
Yeah.
Right. But both of those, I think those sequences were pretty short.
Yeah.
They just kind of back to action sequences up to each other. I mean, even though it was a 6 to 8 minute long, 3 minute scene, the water scene was a fairly short scene. Yeah. Like I think they kept the action paces pretty quick.
Yeah.
Which, like I said, felt different. I wasn't exhausted, but I didn't need, him having to jump off a building to go to the bathroom.
Right.
Or
for instance, like if you know when they trapped the bad guy at the end finally, and they released the gas and all that, and he, you know, kicked the box over that he was in. If he had then escaped, and then you had to go kill him, that would have been way too much. And so I'm glad that they had that sense of brevity to their lengthy, but, you know, to-the-point action sequences that they know when to cut it off.
Mm-hmm.
We got it. You know, and I think they get it. You know, I think they're action veterans, so.
Yeah. But, like I said, if it wasn't for a compare-contrast thing, I think I'd be 100% with you instead of probably, like, 73% with you on that one, Sam.
73.
Yeah.
Then again, as I was saying before, you know, Fantastic Four goes for 100 minutes, and even that drags.
And it's 99 minutes too long.
Exactly. Yeah. But then again, it finishes really quickly. And what? So yeah, I think that this is definitely a better film, and it deserves the lengthier time for sure. Mm.
Yeah.
So Mark, what just made you?
Well, again, I'm tired of the cliche. Let's shut down the IMF. Mm-hmm. I mean, I just think I really want, especially for the next one, because if they do that again, it's just gonna be like, come on, guys, you know.
You're literally saying, come on,
the whole movie. I'm like, this is stupid. I really want them to let the IMF go and like do their thing, mm-hmm. like have their full, you know, full backing, full potential. Let the IMF do the best job that they can, because I think that it can make for a lot of like really cool action sequences and stuff like that. I like the action. I like the characters. I mean, it's hard for me to kind of nitpick, mm-hmm. you know. That was my one kind of like, okay. I mean, come on.
So
when you know, they're all going to do their job anyway.
Well, I guess, like, I wonder if that's why they do it though, you know, because the IMF is so good, right?
Right.
That if they actually had support and backing, then the movie would be over in like 10 minutes.
Yeah.
Right. They'd be like, I mean, oh, well,
that's what I'm saying. Give them a villain worthy of using the entirety of the IMF backing of the government for, give them that, you know, that'd be cool. Yeah. You know, that would be,
then they have to try. Then they'd have to have plot.
Well,
which brings
but
me,
this has great plot. I mean, you know, the what's her, Ilsa. I almost said it wrong like you did.
Wow.
Hey.
Finger pointing.
Burn. She's amazing in that she's kind of half, you know, I read a review that says she's basically half Bond girl, half Bond villain.
Mm-hmm.
And that really adds this kind of depth to her, and she's amazing in this. So it is really kind of hard to nitpick, because I do wish they had, I love the plane sequence and the fact that he really did that. I wish that had more build up.
Yeah.
Instead of just right there at the beginning, which, I mean, it's cool they throw it right there at the beginning, but I wish it had a little more tension. Mm-hmm. I was kind of like, oh, come on, you know, bring that.
Well, it kind of falls in line with everything else, though. It's like the rabbit's foot. We don't know what it is. We don't know what he's trying to get to on the plane. We just care that he finds a wacky way on the plane, and
yeah,
and it's fun and exciting.
I felt like they glossed over it a little bit.
But. And that's the scene that they push in the trailer so much, right? So, you know, I guess maybe it gave me hope that there's something better to come in the film. Although, if you see the scene in the trailer, it's often the best thing, isn't it? But it wasn't here.
Yeah, I would say that was probably one of the biggest differences. And we haven't, I've alluded to this, but we haven't directly compared it to this. But I think this type of film works on the exact same principles we talked about when we talked about Furious 7 on the show earlier this year.
Uh-huh.
It's like enough plot to get us from stunt to stunt to stunt. And unfortunately for me, most of the best stunts in Furious 7, I saw all of those in the trailer. Like, there were, like, three big stunts, and all three of them were in the trailer. Mm-hmm. And this one, we got the plane thing over and over and over again in the trailer, but we didn't get some of the other stuff. We definitely didn't, and I'm, you know, this is probably going to get into some favorite moments, but we didn't even get to there wasn't a hint of the Opera House at all in the trailer. And, you know, that's like the kind of stuff that I'm glad, like, that they didn't give the best parts away.
Mm-hmm.
So they sold us on the fact that it was going to be great and crazy and over the top, but they didn't give away the best.
It would be
sequences.
Literally impossible to include all of the action sequences in a trailer. Cause man, there's a lot.
But so my only real complaint, like I said, cause it was probably my favorite Mission Impossible film yet, probably mostly because he had like a foil, in Ilsa. Because he had a foil there, and that was just really compelling. But I still, there's something, even though we've kind of made it okay, we've ironed it out, we've got the kneader, and we've kneaded the okayness of this not having plot, I still wanted some plot that I understood. I wanted a villain that made me question if he really was the villain.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe that goes to what we hope to see in the next one, But like at no point was I like, this guy is just crazy and weird and has no real like reason for what he's doing. Like I wanted a villain that was bad, but I sometimes couldn't argue with what he was doing. And I feel like with the writer that we got, we couldn't have had that. So so you know, like I said, could be nitpicky, but that's what I wanted. But well, that said, we all enjoyed this.
Yeah.
So hopefully it'll be a lot easier to talk about our favorite moment, favorite moments.
Oh.
You see that there?
Yes. Yeah.
Hashtag awesome. Hashtag spelling. Hashtag hashtag. So Sam, what were the things that you liked most about this movie?
Yeah, you mentioned it earlier. I think the opera scene for me was probably the greatest thing. I just love the direction of it and just the way that the music was used to build the scene. I mean, I'm sure that I've seen that done before, like a kind of dangerous scene in an opera, and that kind of operatic music swelling the action and the emotion. I just can't think of the films. And even just the fact that he pulled out an instrument and uses his gun, like, I didn't really care for that, but oh, it's cool. but yeah, I think I mentioned a few times that I really love the stunts. I think when there's a film with no plot or a very vague plot or a very repeated plot, I'm looking for something new, and I feel like we saw that with the stunts in this film and just the scenes. And you know, any time that a BMW car, it's just beautiful, gets driven downstairs and gets beaten to death. Like, oh, I'm in for that.
Awesome. I love the opera scene. I love that they, you know, the opera was Turandot, which I don't know the opera, but I know the song Nessun Dorma, and that was the climax of, that was the Nessun Dorma. You know, it's this really climactic song. Have you ever heard Pavarotti do it? Or there's this really great metal band called Man of War that does a version of it. It's amazing. Anyway, so I'm a fan of the song, and I was like, oh man, it'd be great if Nessun Dorma was like part of this, and then like climax came, it was Nessun Dorma. So that was really good. I thought it was a great use of music, and you know, how many times have we seen the opera scene? You know, where the action is going on while the opera is going on, and it's like supposed to parallel, you know, with the masks and stuff, and you know, it's supposed to bet the real back and forth. I mean, I think it was the last Bond, it was Quantum of Solace Bond movie did that, and you've seen it like at least 25 times, you know, and I just thought that they did a really, really good job of it, just kind of, you know, like they did with most of the action scenes. You know, I love action with humor spotted through, and where it's kind of like, you know, this is a movie that doesn't wink at the camera but doesn't totally take itself seriously, and so they have fun with it and it's playful. You know, Simon Pegg is always good for that. You know, he's always, any action scene he's in, he's like, oh no, you know, like he's losing his mind, you know, he's kind of fun action kind of guy to have. I loved Ving Rhames and just like the, you know, half a dozen scenes that he was in, and like he just owned the scene, you know, as Ving Rhames. He's this big presence on screen. So I mean, the characters were great, the action's great, the humor is probably the best of any of the films, I think. You could say that even with Brad Bird having done, you know, Ghost Protocol, there was some great humor in that, but this one not even more. And so it really, I think I like movies, I just enjoy movies like that. Like I love Mad Max, but no, there's some humor in the Mad Max, but not, you know, not as much, I guess. But this film did it really well. It's well paced, and it's just an overall enjoyable movie. You could go on and on about all the great sequences there are, and the clever gadgets and all that stuff. But it's overall just really, really enjoyable.
Well, and that's something that I was having a conversation with my wife about one time, talking about how some movies that you wouldn't think would be rated as highly on Rotten Tomatoes, because I'm pretty sure, I don't remember what it ended up at, but this was sitting at like 94%, 92%. And we're trying to have that conversation about like 92% would make you think that this movie is one of the best movies, one that has been made ever, kind of. But I don't think any of us would put it in that category. But when so many things are done right in a film, even if it's not like a transcendent film, if everything's done right, people are more going to be like, well, if I have to give it like a thumbs up or a thumbs down, I'm going to give it a thumbs up because I can really find almost nothing wrong with it.
Mm-hmm.
Like I said, not transcendent, not blowing your mind or anything, but it's enjoyable. And made in such a way that almost everyone thinks it's enjoyable.
Yeah, it's the kind of good that gives you what you ask for.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And there's that some movies are supposed to do that.
Yeah.
Not all movies, but some movies.
I'm keen to know if you guys enjoyed this more than Ant-Man.
No, I liked Ant-Man more.
Ah, okay. Cool.
I confess that I was on vacation when Ant-Man came out, and I still have not gotten a chance to see it. I know.
I thought you'd
I was hoping to avoid that question on this podcast.
So, I've seen it. No, so
I figured it was unavoidable.
Well, I like Ant-Man for a number of different reasons. Most of them are that I think it has, even though it's silly at sometimes, it has more heart than this does. But
sure.
Good use of CGI, good action. I mean, we talked about this last podcast, but I mean, how about you, Sam? Like apples and oranges?
Yeah, no, I didn't love Ant-Man. I'm one of the very few that didn't love Ant-Man. And I listened to your last podcast, and everyone loved it, and I thought, but I definitely liked Mission Impossible more. Yeah. Huh. Anyway, I interrupted you. You keep going.
Oh, no. So, I mean, I would kind of wrap us up with favorite moments here. Almost like a bullet point list. Rebecca Ferguson killed it. Loved her.
Oh, yeah.
Every time she was on screen, I was just like, I'm completely interested in what her character is doing.
Yeah.
Mark didn't just hint at this. Mark basically was talking about this. I called it, instead of like humor necessarily, I called it the film embracing its own ridiculousness. Like, as the Mission Impossible films have kind of almost outgrown themselves, like they realize that they're getting bigger and crazier. And there are so many references in this film, especially at the beginning when Jeremy Renner's character, Brent, is in there talking to Hanley, and they're explaining like, well, this happened and this happened, which you might say was total luck, or this, which was also total luck.
Yeah,
I mean, talking about how so many close calls and throwing back to all the previous Mission Impossible movies and how it is portrayed or is made. Have you to think about it as like Ethan Hunt's skill, but it's basically like the skin of his teeth, luck.
Yeah.
And so they're making fun of the fact that like the only reason these have done anything is because of luck. They have Simon Pegg's character Benji basically remarking that like, oh look, he's totally fine. I mean, improbable, but not impossible, which is basically what most people label their reviews for Mission Impossible movies.
Yeah.
You know, and so kind of poking fun at,
which is one of the great lines of the movie, and it's almost meta the way that you're saying it, where you know, Benji was like, you know, she's like, well, you gotta hold your breath for 3 months underwater. I mean, that's impossible. And he's like, oh, don't worry about him.
Yeah, he's just like, you know, like he can do it. Of course he can do it. And so it's like their own commentary, like basically making or poking fun at the reviews that are poking fun at them, like understanding the ridiculousness of the film. And I think the last scene was something Mark had mentioned earlier as well, the prime minister scene, where Hanley or Alec Baldwin's character is going on and on and on and basically describes like what we're all thinking as an audience, being like, you know, Ethan is the very epitome of this and this. He could be doing this right now. And yeah, it's just so, it's almost cheesy, but it's so great because you know, you might not know who Ethan is, but you know Ethan's one of those people in that room.
Yeah.
You know? And so it's so incredibly amusing that he's saying that. And we know exactly why he's saying it because we know Ethan's in the room somewhere. So all that, what I consider embracing its own ridiculousness was great. And I think the last thing, it's almost all I could think about when the movie was over. And I told Mark about this, and I was telling my wife about this, that Simon Pegg was obviously hilarious in this movie. You know, he there wasn't too much, there wasn't too little, it was like just the right amount. And I just couldn't stop thinking that Simon Pegg has to be having the most fun of anyone in the entire world. I mean, like, think about the people that this guy, like, he is friends now with Brad Bird, and J.J. Abrams, but he's also and Edgar Wright. So he is, like, some of the most important directors of, like, our time. Simon Pegg is friends with all these people, and he's friends with Tom Cruise.
Yeah.
But it's not just that he's, like, a guy that gets to be in action movies. He's also, like, writing a Star Wars movie. He gets to be in... he's writing a Star Trek movie.
Yeah.
And he gets to be in the Star Trek movie. He's gonna, since he knows J.J. Abrams, he gets to be in Star Wars.
In Star Wars, yeah.
You know, like... Mm. He just gets to do everything.
Like, everything.
And... It just he makes
indie movies, he makes comedies, dramas, he makes big budget movies. He's
zombie movies,
characters,
parody, like,
yeah.
And he just looks like he's having fun in every single one of them. Like I said, working with some of the best writers and directors that we get to watch.
Yeah.
And I just, like I said, it's hard for me to imagine anyone having more fun than Simon Pegg right now. If you could tell me...
He shows up on The Tonight Show, Jimmy Fallon, yeah, doing Drunk Ron Weasley.
Yeah, it's just... it's like he could do anything right now.
Yeah.
Just because, I don't know. So, that's all I could think about. I was like, if I could actually, you know, lots of people would be like, oh, yes, I would be this person or this person. I was like, I would trade places with Simon Pegg for a day, yeah, and just be like, I get to be in Star Wars. I get to be in Star Trek.
Yeah.
Oh, man. Anyway, so he just looks like he's having a great time, and I'm enjoying him more than I ever have before, and that's saying something, because I've always really loved Simon Pegg, from Doctor Who episodes to Space to, you know, whatever he's been in. So it's just fun to watch. So my favorite thing ever is Simon Pegg. Done. So, all right. So, Sam, any final thoughts about this film before we close?
Oh, I just think I really, at the end of blockbuster season, I really appreciated it. I think it started blockbuster season for us. I think started with Mad Max, mm-hmm, and then in the middle we got Jurassic World, which I didn't love. Ant-Man, didn't love that, and a bunch of other films that I was just like, seen this before. So I just found it a real relief to be able to go and enjoy a movie. Not switch off my brain, but just sit back with popcorn and just really have a good time. And I think it's going to... Mm-hmm. And also, this film sat well with me. It wasn't a film that I forgot about. The next day, mm-hmm, I wanted to see it again. And that doesn't happen often. So, yeah, I think I'm looking forward to seeing this more when it comes out on home media. Mm.
Mm-hmm. Nice. Mark, any final thoughts?
No, I mean, I think I hope they... You know, and they are. They've already said that they're starting to plan the next one. I mean... Mm-hmm. Keep them coming. I mean, you don't really say that about, fivequels? Quintquels?
Yeah.
You know, you got sequels.
20 years of films.
Once you get... Yeah. I mean, seriously, that's actually 20 years of films. The first one was 95 or 6.
Well, it won't be too long now before we're making the same jokes about Tom Cruise that we're making about, like, Keith Richards for the Rolling Stones, you know?
Yeah. Like, well, and that's, yeah, and I think that's a testament to what he does in these movies, and mm-hmm, that they should keep making them.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, how many fifth movies have we had that, all right, and have they been good enough to want, give me 2 or 3 more?
Well, I wouldn't even have to go to 5. I would say, how many fourth movies have we gotten? 3rd movies? I mean, like, I don't really want to, I feel like we've really explored all of Jurassic World at this point.
Yes,
you know.
Yeah,
like, I mean, I'm sure they're gonna think of something, and it's fun to watch dinosaurs, but, like,
yeah,
you know,
I think it's a very limited franchise, because, you know, the first movie is it, basically, and then it's just, mm-hmm, repeat, rinse and repeat. Yep.
Yeah, but see, but that's the thing, so is this.
Well, they kind of a hint. Well, it is, but it is, but there's a little bit more, you know, you're not just running from a dinosaur. Which was fun in the first movie, but is repetitive, because you have to invent some way to run from a dinosaur, you know, like, whereas with these, it's like, well, maybe we can hang off a building. Well, maybe we can hang off a plane. Maybe we can get shot out of a tank. You know, hey, what's next?
Oh, thunder.
Yeah.
Whoa.
Speaking of getting shot out of a tank, did you see that? That was awesome.
It was like right there, wasn't it?
It's like,
oh, that's not good. You can actually hear that pretty well. That's not good.
Yeah.
All right. Well, with that, then we'll finally wind it down. So I am always very appreciative of people taking the time to talk film with me. It's one of my great pleasures in life, especially when we get someone from the future. So Sam, thank you so much for being here. How can people find what you do on the internet and other mediums?
Yeah. Website Real Gospel. So REEL-gospel.com. And I'm also on Sydney's Hope 103.2, which you can stream online, but times are all weird. I'm on at night and you are asleep when that's happening. So don't bother with that. But yeah, check out Real Gospel.
Well, I mean, you know, for all the Australian fans that we now have.
Exactly. That's right. Yeah, yeah.
That's right.
Yeah.
So make sure to check Sam out there. Mark, where can people find what you're doing?
Find me on Twitter, Mark Wingdinger. That's my Twitter handle. And then I write on Real World Theology. It's R-E-E-L.
That's
just
right.
Just like Real Gospel.
Yeah.
Well, it's so clever. It's like we all thought of this by ourselves.
I know. It's genius. I forgot to say my Twitter handle is Sam Square Eyes as well, if you want to find me there.
Okay, cool. And I'll make sure to have all this in the show notes. So anyone wanting to connect with these guys or follow the things they have to say about film and life and stuff, you will be able to find that at the website. But you can follow me at Physification. You can follow the Real World Theology at Real World Theo on Twitter. If you'd like to know more about Real World Theology, you want to see the show notes, you want to read more reviews from our talented group of writers, then go to realworldtheology.com, as we said, R-E-E-L, worldtheology.com. Connect with us on Facebook and Twitter, and look for new episodes on the 1st, 10th, and 20th of every month. You can find us on iTunes, you can find us on Stitcher. If you like what you hear, subscribe. It's a lot easier to get it that way. If you enjoy it, please review the show. We always appreciate not only reviews, but 5-star reviews. It helps more people find us, more people involved in the conversation, better conversations, more fun, more friends, all kinds of awesome stuff. And on that note, I want to send a big thank you out to Daring Macalope for giving us a 5-star review and saying some very nice things about the show. So thank you for that iTunes review. Again, we're so grateful for our excellent guests, the excellent conversations they bring to the show. Without them, it would just be me saying a lot. And I appreciate them kind of filling in all the stuff around me saying
Yeah.
So,
so
please follow them on social media and around the web or on the radio in Australia. Meanwhile, we are so thankful for you, the listeners, for taking time to make us part of your week. And until next episode, remember that story is powerful and entertainment is not mindless. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. We get most of our TVs from you guys, so you give us all the good stuff. That's okay.
Actually, I would probably beg to differ.
Really?
Because we basically think that the BBC gives us all the good stuff.
Oh, okay. Right. Yeah, no, I don't know.
But I can understand, as an Australian, how you would basically pretend that Britain doesn't exist, you know, for various reasons.
Yes.
Hashtag history.
The motherland.